You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 22nd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, from Rolling Stone magazine, Matt Taibbi. On Bank of America, too crooked to fail. Also on the program today, President Obama fast tracks at least the southern part of Keystone XL in a slap to all of us. Let's be honest. Unless some of you are TransCanada oil moguls, it's really a slap at all of us. The Progressive Caucus comes out with its own budget. And
surprise, surprise.
Not only does it cut the deficit far more than Paul Ryan's fake flim-flam of a budget, it also does so without subjecting the majority of us to shared or unshared sacrifice, I should say, that actually invests in America. You won't hear anybody talk about it just about anywhere else, so we'll be talking about that today. Also on the program, Komen Foundation. Ooh, they're having problems now. Turns out when you're a charity that supports women's health, when you try to undercut women's health, the people who support your charity tend to wonder why they're supporting a charity. Who knew? Last night in New York City, somewhere between 1 and 3,000 protesters participated in the Million Hoodies March. The event was organized by Occupy Wall Street and Occupy the Hood. It wasn't? Are you sure about that?
I know Occupy the Hood had a lot to do with it, but it was not an Occupy Wall Street event.
It was, I mean, I know that there were Occupy organizers involved in the, maybe it wasn't an official event. I don't know. There's some question as to that. But nevertheless, 1 to 3,000 people were there protesting the shooting of Trayvon Martin and the police response to the shooting of Trayvon Martin and the broader laws that made such a shooting almost inevitable if you mix in a healthy dose of racism and, of course, the inclusion of a certain sect of the population who always likes to play, Charles Bronson in Death Wish. Martin's parents, Tracy Martin and Sabrina Fulton, attended the march. The rally started in Union Square. They then marched up to 23rd Street in New York City. They then marched back down past Union Square. The march sort of broke off into two different parts. Part of it ended up all the way down to the Brooklyn Bridge and to police headquarters. And then ended late at night. At about 1:30 in the morning, I was watching a couple of the live streams coming out of Union Square. And there was as big a police presence, I think, as there's been at any protest since the time that the police stormed Zuccotti Park to kick people out from just hanging out in the park. And the cops looked like they were itching for a fight. We will play some audio later in the program where you can see the cops trying to frankly, it reminded me of those scenes in the Planet of the Apes, the old one, not the most recent one, where the gorillas just start getting each other riled up so they can go, ride on the horses and capture one of the human beings. I can't remember. And meanwhile, last night as well, city commissioners from Sanford, Florida, this is the suburb of Orlando, where Trayvon Martin was shot and killed. If you ask me, murdered by this guy Zimmerman. And the city commissioners gave a vote of no confidence to the police chief, Bill Lee. I believe it was a 3-2 vote. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone. He's got a massive piece in Rolling Stone on just how horrible Bank of America is and how you and I, with our tax dollars, are enabling this horribleness. We'll be right back after this. All right. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to this program once again Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone magazine. Hello, Matt. How are you?
What's going on, Sam?
Just hanging out. I'm a little bit tired today. I'm a broadcast professional. You would have no idea that was the case if I hadn't told you that.
That's right. I would never have known if you didn't tell me.
It would have been a complete, you would have walked away saying, "Bye, Sam sounds like he's very well rested." So, you got a blockbuster piece in Rolling Stone magazine that is, I mean, you could just take it down to your local police department and and simply just put it on file as a rap sheet, but you outline how Bank of America is both. Oh, boy. I mean, how to put this? They're both, in some respects, incompetent, but really, more importantly, they are so rife with fraud. Their history has been so rife with fraud. They almost grounded in a... They exist almost from a seed of just horribleness that has sort of grown into a wonderful forest of just corruption.
A publicly subsidized forest.
Yes, and let's go through this. I mean, it's a huge piece, and you know these. I mean, it's sort of breathtaking when you sit back, you read this thing, and you sort of absorb this. Just how it really speaks to a larger problem in this country, I think, particularly because of the size of this bank. But just for a moment, talk about how big Bank of America is and how it got that way.
Well, right now, Bank of America controls about 12% of all the banking deposits in the country, which it's not supposed to do. We actually have a cap that says that no bank can control more than 10%, but they kind of got around those rules because there's a little loophole that says that you're allowed to temporarily go over that amount if it's an acquisition. So they went over that amount. They now control roughly 17 to 18% of the mortgage market as well. So when you're looking at the sheer financial assets of the United States, between banking deposits and real estate, you know, Bank of America is essentially, you know, 10 to 15% of the American financial services industry. That's not rude. That's not an exaggeration at all. So it's a gigantic company that's getting more and more gigantic all the time.
And this is a bank that essentially came out of it started, I guess, in North Carolina. It wasn't
right.
It grew and grew and grew. And you talk about how it started from this sort of competition as to who had more swagger between these two guys in North Carolina, Hugh McCall and Ed Crutchfield. Just talk about that, because I think, you know, the interesting thing is it didn't have to be this way. And there's no, at the end of the day, there is really no rationale for a bank to be this big.
No. I mean, and a lot of the people that I talked to said that, pointed to the fact that, going back to the end of the 90s, there were all these studies that had been conducted about what's the most efficient size for a bank. And they all kind of universally agree that once you get over about $5 billion in assets, the efficiency starts to go down. In large part because the loan quality starts to suffer, and one of the main advantages that a small regional bank has is that it knows who it's lending money to. It sees the people physically. It has a good idea of what kind of investments it's getting itself into. And then once you get to the point where it's a gigantic, you know, international conglomerate that's making decisions based on scoring systems and computerized formulas rather than face-to-face contact, they start to make worse and worse decisions. So there's no capitalist rationale for making a bigger bank. It's not more profitable. It just happens that this particular company is run by a guy who just wanted to get bigger. This guy, Hugh McCall, and his adversary, Ed Crutchfield, who ran First Union, he ended up creating Wachovia, which became Wells Fargo. And so it was this rivalry to see who could have the taller skyscraper, and that's really what it was all about. These guys just wanted to be bigger for the sake of it.
It's essentially, and of course, if we were to have capped that and prevented it, we would have been reducing the amount of freedom for a couple of jerk-offs
right.
to be jerk-offs at the expense, ultimately, of the taxpayer and the broader economy.
Yeah, and this is a kind of an important point, because the argument in favor of Bank of America or this kind of company is, well, we shouldn't have regulations that prevent companies from getting as organically big as they want to get. But the problem is Bank of America actually benefited from state regulations. It could never have gotten as big as it got without protection from the government. In the mid-80s, there used to be a law that said that you couldn't have a bank in more than one state. So all banks were intrastate banks, the biggest ones. Then there was a ruling in the mid-80s, a Supreme Court ruling, that says that you could cross state lines within a designated area. That allowed Bank of America to start gobbling up banks in the Southeast, but it also protected them from banks in New York, which could not cross into their designated area. So they were allowed to go on the shopping spree where they didn't have to compete with Citibank and other major depository institutions that were much bigger than they were. So it's not like this is a freedom argument. They got as much state aid in getting big as they did, as there was state aid repressing them in the early days.
Yeah, I mean, I think this has been an ongoing argument that I have had with libertarians calling into the program, this notion of like we just need to reduce government to a certain extent, and that's a perfect example of, you know, at one point you stop reducing government and there's still protections, and inevitably they go to the guy who's paying for who's contributing most to the campaigns of local politicians, and they get the benefit right. that way.
Sure.
And you know, you quoted him, I think, McCall, as saying that we realized if we didn't leave North Carolina, we would never amount to anything. That we would not be important.
Right, right. Not that we wouldn't be profitable, but that we wouldn't be important. And I think a lot of people that I talked to pointed that out, is that what really motivated these guys is that they just wanted to be bigger. They wanted to be something. You know, they were like Marlon Brando in the, on the waterfront. You know, I could have been somebody, you know. And I think that's what these guys, they didn't want to be provincial hicks from North Carolina. They wanted to be world-class financiers. And that always-get-bigger mindset was what it ultimately should have destroyed the company back in 2007 and 2008. Bank of America, this guy McCall had already acquired the San Francisco-based bank, Bank of America, and he was already a thriving mortgage company, but he wanted to be the biggest mortgage dealer in America. So he went and he bought Countrywide, which was a gigantic ball of fraud and future litigation. It was already collapsing in 2007, but he doubled down on the mistake. He invested in it, and then he bought it. And that should have destroyed the company because it left them with this gigantic pile of liabilities. But they ended up getting a gigantic federal bailout to keep them in business. And again, it's just that instinct to always get bigger that kept leading them into trouble.
And do you think that that he bought Countrywide at that time because they were aware they had a massive problem on their hands, and he thought Countrywide was going to save the company? I mean, you know, when I read it now, I mean, I remember when Bank of America acquired Countrywide, but when, you know, with the sobriety of hindsight, I realized, wait, they bought this company in 2008 on the precipice of all this falling apart. They bought they added this type of liability. I mean, now when you look back on it, it looks like a Hail Mary.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways to look at it. You know, the way I look at it, people have to realize that these companies like Countrywide and Long Beach, and New Century, there were sort of these fly-by-night subprime lenders. They had a very particular role in the mortgage business, which was they were completely unscrupulous. Their job was to give loans to everybody that had a pulse, everybody they could find. And the banks knew they were doing this. Now, they didn't want to get their hands dirty personally, the companies like Bank of America and Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. But they did want to do business with these companies. They lent them billions of dollars. They basically said, go out and make loans to everybody you can find. We'll buy those loans back, and then we'll chop them up and sell them off to unions and pension funds and foreigners and make it look like AAA-rated, you know, good investments. So they were essentially outsourcing their predatory criminal lending to companies like Countrywide and New Century and Long Beach. And my take on this whole thing is when Countrywide started to falter, they just essentially decided to buy up the whole mess to try to keep it in-house. I mean, that's one take on it. Certainly, it turned out that way, that they kind of concentrated all their liability under one roof rather than having it out there in separate litigations.
Do you think it's also possible that BOFA bought Countrywide because they figured, like, we need to be even a bigger problem? In other words, I've heard, I think it was Joseph Stiglitz who told me that Cibris bought Chrysler knowing full well that ultimately they would get a government bailout. And it seems to me that, you know, in this situation, if you're going down and your ship is taking on water, and you have the opportunity to sort of like, oh, there's the crown prince. I'm going to grab them and put him on the boat.
Right,
I'm sure
right.
to get rescued in that situation. That they actually assumed more of this liability as a way of making them an even more explosive. You know, once you have BOFA and Countrywide together, the liability is so great. And Merrill Lynch, the liability is so great that there's almost no chance that they're not going to get some type of bailout.
I mean, I guess it would be hard to prove that kind of intent. I mean, this is kind of the difference between first and second degree murder, I guess. But, you know, they clearly that happened, and clearly that dynamic ended up coming into play, that once they had Countrywide and Merrill Lynch and Bank of America, which is already, you know, owns 10% of America's deposits under that one roof, there was no way the government could allow them to go over the edge. It would just, especially in that chaos of 2008, when all these different companies were teetering on the edge of collapse, I think the government must have identified this company and said, this is one of the five or six companies we can't allow to collapse, because it would just, the footprint would be too huge if they were to go under. And yeah, who knows? Maybe that was a motivation. It's not a very smart motivation. Well, I mean, who knows? It is. I mean, they've essentially won a get out of jail free card for life now by making that acquisition. So, I mean, who knows?
And we should say that when you say that Countrywide, their modus operandi was to go out and make these horrible loans consciously. You know, not this right. is not a measure. This is not incompetence. This is consciously saying, like, we're going to strip the primary function of a mortgage lender's sort of, you know, raison d'etre, which is to actually make sure that they're giving out good loans. You note that a federal judge in a SEC investigation, and there's a quote, Countrywide routinely ignored its official underwriting guidelines to such extent that Countrywide would underwrite any loan it could sell.
Right.
It's completely contrary to why these entities function.
Well, yeah, unless you look at it for what its real purpose was. People need to understand that this whole thing was a scam. You know, if you here in New York, if you look out your window, you see people selling, you know, phony Prada pocketbooks out in the street. That's exactly what they were doing with these mortgages. The whole thing was a scam to take loans, chop them up, disguise them as better performing loans, and then sell them to pension funds and unions and foreigners and insurance companies all over the world. And so they needed the raw material. They needed to create these loans so that they could put them into the grinder and apply a whole bunch of phony baloney derivative math to them and rechristen them AAA rated securities. So Countrywide's entire purpose was to create loans. It wasn't to create good loans, because they weren't going to hold them. As soon as they made those loans, they sold them off to back to a company like Bank of America, who in turn sold them off immediately to some other sucker down the line. So they had no interest in making a good loan, because they didn't care. They weren't gonna have that loan for more than 10 seconds. And so, yeah, they had essentially no lending standards. Their standards were, do we already have a customer for the loan?
And we should say that, you know, just to add to that analogy about somebody goes and buys something on the street and they come home, they take it, they take it home and they find it's defective. The difference here is that there is no indication to the customer in this situation that they're buying something off the street from just a vendor on
right.
the street. I mean, you know, most people don't work in these industries, and they assume if I walk into a place that is issuing mortgages, they know what they're doing, and it's sanctioned, and they're operating under guidelines.
Yeah, no, and it goes even farther than that. I mean, if you go into a supermarket and you buy a steak that has a, you know, USDA grade A stamp on it, well, you think that that's good quality meat, right? And that's essentially what you had with these loans. They had the stamp of approval of Moody's and Standard & Poor's and all the good ratings agencies who gave a lot of these loans AAA ratings. And of course, it turned out later that these ratings agencies were financially dependent upon those banks, and that they were essentially selling their high ratings to these companies. But if you're a union fund manager and you're, you know, from the state of Mississippi and or, you know, Los Angeles County, and you're going to buy an investment for your pension fund, and somebody says, and Bank of America, you know, the world's biggest bank, for one of them anyway, says to you, here's a AAA rated security, are you really going to wonder, you know, are you really going to think that it might actually be a loan belonging to an unemployed janitor from, you know, the slums of Arizona? I mean, you just don't make that connection in your mind. At least you didn't before. Now people do.
All right. So now I want to move past the acquisition of Countrywide, but there's still, it's still just sort of, it just boggles the mind because we know, and you report here that there was an internal email distributed in June of 2006, where Countrywide's own executives worried that 40% of the firm's reduced documentation loans, which are these sort of liar loans where you come in and say, like, you know, we'll trust you as to what,
right.
you know, and,
right.
and people are encouraged to do this because, of course, it means that they can avoid their own company's standards. They knew that had income overstated more than 10%, a significant percent of those loans would have been overstated by 50% or more. We also know that U.S. Bancorp, in a later lawsuit, said that they saw that once they bought Countrywide's loans, they became delinquent and defaulted at a startling rate. How does a company like Bank of America go in and before they do an acquisition, I know they send over forensic auditors, right? I mean, mm-hmm. they're called forensic auditors. How do they not find that?
Oh, no, they find it. I mean, they know. They clearly know, and Countrywide clearly knew. That these loans were not of the same quality that they were representing. Look, again, this was a scam. This was all about creating stuff to sell to somebody else who didn't know what they were buying. At the Countrywide level, they were saying to people who were taking out these loans, okay, I mean, you make $30,000, but maybe sometimes you make $40,000 or $50,000, right? And they would boost the income levels like that in the applications. And everybody knew that this was going on. They knew it at Countrywide. They knew it at the banks who were buying the loans. It was only the customer who was three or four links down the chain. He was the one who didn't know about all this stuff. It was a systematic effort at covering up the poor quality of these loans.
And then then there's another sort of half of the equation of this cover-up ends up coming on the foreclosure side. In other words, because they were creating this mill where they would just sort of securitize these loans, and they were doing such a volume business, they had to basically take shortcuts. And then, explain that because
they didn't have to. They did.
Right.
Let's put it this way. Okay, so if you're a bank in the old days and you issue a loan to somebody and you're going to hold that loan for 20 or 30 years, well, you're going to properly service that loan. Like if you're going to resell it, you'll walk down to the county clerk's office and you'll pay the fee to do the deed transfer, and you'll physically pick up that piece of paper and move it from one place to another like you're supposed to by law. But because these banks, their whole game was let's get a whole bunch of loans and then sell them off and take off with the money. They just stopped doing their paperwork. Once they made that loan, packaged it, and sold it off, they washed their hands of it and stopped doing their work. And so not only did they not do their paperwork anymore, they didn't pay the local fees that they were supposed to for deed transfers every time these loans were sold or bought and sold. And so the only time they did the paperwork was when someone had to foreclose on the property. They just went back and they made up all the paperwork. They assigned whole details of like entry level kids and said, we'd like you to reconstitute the history of this loan, and then you can sign it as a vice president or something, and we'll get a notary to stamp it. And it's just a mass perjury operation. That's what robo-signing is.
I mean, it's fascinating because you start to see how it's sort of, it's, you know, it's one of those people who, you know, you tell one lie and then, you know, months later, you've got to tell a dozen more lies to support that first lie. And that's the thing, is that this is so large. It's almost as if, because, you know, right now, of course, this country is suffering dramatically in terms of the recession because of the loss of home value. But it was this banking industry that inflated this bubble so significantly and then created its own financial crisis, which sort of precipitated, or I guess was an immediate result of this bubble exploding. And so it really is. That's the amazing thing again about your piece. I'm not blowing smoke here. Is just that
it's the scale of it that's so amazing.
Yes.
Right.
So if it was not bad enough that they They fraudulently foreclosed on people. They skirted, and if they had to file that paperwork, of course, much of this, it seems to me, would have been much harder to do. I don't know that it would have made it impossible,
oh, yeah.
but it would have certainly made it much harder to do.
Yeah, and let's just talk for a minute about how they skirted it. What they did is the banks got together and they created a private electronic registry system called MERS, where instead of doing the physical deed transfers, they just paid a few pennies to some company called MERS, which became technically the owner of like a third of America's mortgages. And they didn't ask anybody for permission to do this. They didn't go to the government and say, hey, we don't want to do the paperwork anymore, so we're going to hire this company to do it by computer. They just went ahead and did it. And when they did that, they allowed all the banks in America to systematically evade local fees, you know, probably for hundreds of billions of dollars. But that's just a small aside in this whole picture. But that's how they did it.
And then, on top of that, just to sort of almost like prove the point that this wasn't an anomaly, like, you know, we headed down this road, we just had to keep going. They're engaged in all different other types of fraud that just seem to just reflect just an incredible culture of corruption there.
Right.
Talk about what they did with Hamp.
Well, yeah, in that instance, it's unclear exactly what the benefit was to these banks, but HAMP was this program from the Obama administration that essentially would give money to the banks, and the banks would then distribute that money to struggling homeowners who were having trouble making their payments. It was an incentive for the banks to provide modifications of loans for people who were near foreclosure. But what Bank of America got caught doing was they would consistently promise people that they would get this HAMP modification, and then when it came time to actually give out the mod, they would stop picking up their phone, and or they would kind of systematically say the dog ate my homework, and whenever it came time to deliver, they would just not do it. There are some people who allege that they took their end of the HAMP money and then just held and then didn't distribute it to the actual homeowners, but yeah, that's something that they got caught doing.
And then they dragged it out and would foreclose on these people.
So essentially, instead of foreclosing and pulling the band-aid off quickly and putting people into foreclosure and where they can start getting on with their lives again, now you're saying we'd like to get a couple more payments from you, and they drag the process out for 4, 5, 6, 8 more months. They get that many more payments, and then at the end, they still get foreclosed on. So it's just like doubling down on the misery.
And then in South Carolina, they were distributing the unemployment benefits through basically debit cards, and they screwed those people.
Right, yeah. No, they got a contract to distribute unemployment insurance benefits, and so people would get these little prepaid Bank of America cards. But then it turned out afterwards that if you didn't use a Bank of America ATM machine, or remember in South Carolina, in some of these places, like, you know, if people live 30 miles from the nearest Bank of America ATM machine, if you didn't use a Bank of America ATM, you could pay fees of as much as $10 per time per withdrawal. So I'm sure that's not what the state had in mind when it decided to give out that contract.
And when you're talking about $10 a pop for people on unemployment, that's a big deal.
Oh yeah, yeah, and again, it runs completely counter to what this what the spirit of unemployment insurance benefits are, and why should Bank of America get a cut of any of that stuff? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
and then you get into things like go ahead.
No, well, why would South Carolina even make that deal at that point? I mean, you know, if it's supposedly convenience, well, I mean, it's not convenient to pay $10 unless you're willing to drive 30 miles to get your cash.
Right, right. Yeah, no, this is a kind of a phenomenon that's going on all over the country where we're outsourcing various financial services to banks like Bank of America and Chase. And so, you know, when you pay out welfare benefits or unemployment insurance benefits or tax returns, now suddenly instead of just writing a check and sending it to the person in the mail, you know, now they're getting it through a bank, they're getting a prepaid debit card, and the bank is getting some kind of cut, like 1.5% on the whole deal. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but it adds up to money, that, and it's just free money for the banks. I mean, they don't really have to do anything for it. So, yeah, it's a strange kind of trade-off for sure.
And then there's about a half a dozen different ways that these guys have either gotten direct payments of tax dollars or gotten essentially 0% loans of tax dollars, or have offloaded hundreds of billions of dollars worth of crappy mortgages that taxpayers have to make up for. The one thing I want to talk about, because this still sort of shocks me, and it seems to me it's a sort of a ticking time bomb here, is the move of Merrill Lynch assets into other, essentially different books in Bank of America so that they could be backstopped. Right. Explain that to us.
Yeah, so last summer, Bank of America was in trouble, right? A whole bunch of their creditors and counterparties were freaking out because, you know, Bank of America acquired Merrill Lynch, and Merrill Lynch had this whole portfolio of, like, really exotic, complicated derivative instruments, mostly based on mortgages, that were sitting there and they could unwind, and if they went the wrong way, then suddenly there's this massive string of losses on Bank of America's books. And so their creditors and counterparties said, hey, we're not going to lend you any more money, or we're going to start demanding cash from you unless you move all that crap from Merrill Lynch onto Bank of America. Because if you move it to Bank of America's books, now it's FDIC insured, and if it all blows up, we don't have to pay for it. The state will pay for it. And so that's what Bank of America did. They moved about $2.5 trillion worth of stuff from Merrill Lynch to Bank of America, and now if it all blows up, we get to pay for it.
How is that
instead
legal?
Of their creditors. Well, the Federal Reserve Act, and the funny thing about this, it says that you're allowed to do that as long as the instruments are generally of high quality. Now, some people don't believe that this stuff is of high quality, and there's certainly a difference of opinion in the government as to whether that's legal or not. But the fact of the matter is that this is actually done all the time. The reason that this is it was noticed in Bank of America's case is that it was such an outrageous example of when you shouldn't do it. I mean, this is a company that's in serious trouble, and the instruments in question were particularly dangerous. But we actually allow this all the time. Companies like Goldman and Citi, they do this all the time.
So in the final analysis, when it comes to all the bailouts, and certainly we in the most recent bailout, as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that they got off with this DOJ-brokered financial fraud settlement deal, which is just the latest, essentially, bailout for this company.
Right.
At the end of the day, what we could have done with this company is, it's one thing to sort of bail it out to maintain the financial system, but at that point, we should have started dismantling this thing slowly and in a controlled manner, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Everybody I talked to, you know, who's kind of like-minded on this topic, they all said the same thing. This company, if it's too big to fail, it's too big to exist. So what we should do is just take it over. You know, if it needs a bailout, we should just come in, take it over, sell it off into smaller regional banks, and basically undo that shopping spree that guys like Hugh McCall went on when they just started buying stuff to get bigger. This could be a series of very effective companies if they were smaller regional banks. But instead, what we're doing is we're allowing this company that has a long history of fraud and bid rigging and trying to rig the LIBOR, you know, the international interest rates, and it's a rogue criminal organization, and we're keeping it in business, which is like a double whammy, right? Because not only are we supporting an inefficient institution, but we're also looking the other way towards crime and fraud, which guarantees that more of it's going to happen.
Right.
So it's the wrong decision all the way around.
It's just unbelievable. It's a great piece. Matt Taibbi, thanks so much for coming on and walking us through this. It really is. If people really want to fully get a sense, it's a great – Bank of America is a great metaphor. In fact, I guess it's not even a metaphor. It's a big part of it for just what went wrong and what is still incredibly wrong with our financier sector. I can't recommend this piece enough.
All right, Sam. Thanks a lot, man. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon. All right, folks. We are going to head into the better half of the program. On the better half of the program today, Josh Orton will be calling in to give us an update on what's happening with Walkergate and the recall election against Scott Walker. And hold on, stop the music. I want to try and do this casually. Hey, everybody, what's going on? Hey, how you doing? What are you doing today? Oh, really? Oh, I'm just sitting here sweating in this extremely hot studio that we have. That's really not a studio. It's an office. Hey, why not become a member of the Majority Report? You know, folks, don't forget that as a member of the Majority Report, and if you haven't gotten your swag yet, send us an email with the subject line swag. Go to the Majority Report, become a member or member benefits, and you will see what swag is available. It's a DVD, and it's either the critically acclaimed Who's the Caboose or the critically acclaimed Pilot Season comedy videos or the not-so-much critically acclaimed Bad Situationist or the highly critically acclaimed FUBAR, the right-wing nightmare.
FUBAR, America's right-wing nightmare.
We'll send you one of those. And if you become a Cedarista, we'll send you two. And if you become a Cedarista, you're eligible for the People versus the RNC documentary. We just have a couple of those left. That's where I get almost thrown out of the RNC in 2004 by the Secret Service. And I... because I was going around looking to talk to a gay Republican. And I think on that video, I also say to Ann Coulter, I tell her that a dinosaur wags her tail 20 minutes after her head's lopped off, suggesting that her time was... that's what it was. I asked her if she was Andy Kaufman, and she pretended like she didn't know who he was. And, all sorts of fun stuff on that. So you get swag, but you also get... an extra 50 minutes of the show. And if you don't even want the 50 minutes of the show, you don't want the swag, you're supporting the show. You're supporting independent media. Name another place you can get. Oh, you know what? Let's read this email. Somebody actually sent in an email and asked me to read this. I may have to read it tomorrow because I forgot to pull it. But, oh, here it is. Okay. Hey, Sam, could you please read my email to your listeners who have not become members yet? This is from listener Diane. I don't think people realize how rare and special the Majority Report is. Oh, well, thank you. Trying to find rational, sane, progressive views in the media is very hard. In L.A., we just lost Tom Hartman on the radio. You never know how long some progressive will be on the air. Also, there's probably no reason 98% of your listeners can't find a way to pay to become a member. I'm unemployed and have given up a lot of things in my life, but supporting Sam to continue to be on the air is a top priority for me. I remember circa 2003 how hard it was to find a progressive voice, and I thought I was losing my mind. You can't find something to sacrifice to pay $10 a month. That's nothing for the price of sanity. The propaganda wars are just getting worse. People stand up for your principles and support the Majority Report or risk losing it altogether. Thanks, Diane. P.S. You are way better than Marin. You misspelled it, but the point still remains. All right, folks. Don't forget, if you want your swag, you got a request. Send an email to majorityreporters@gmail.com. Subject line, swag. Tell us which DVD you want. Otherwise, we don't know what to send you. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, organic, 10% coupon code majority. If you listen via iTunes, leave us a review on iTunes. Bring more people into the show. We got merch. Don't forget, donate your account. Those whippersnappers over at Citizen Radio are starting to lap us now. What are you going to do? It's two of them. It's only one of me. And just living high on the hog. You just hear Jamie saying to Allison, hey, you do all the stuff today. Okay. Hey, tomorrow you do all the stuff. And Jamie probably says, no. That's the sense I get of that dynamic. But All right, folks. See you in the better half. Coming up next, Josh Orton.